Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on Ring of Fire, Paul Waldman from the American Prospect will tell us why he thinks the media will need to change the way it covers President Trump by pressuring him to tell the truth or face getting steamrolled. Zoe Carpenter from The Nation magazine will join us to discuss the Senate confirmation hearing on Betsy DeVos and why Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of Education didn't come close to making the grade. Writer and advocate for universal basic income, Scott Santons, will be here to explain how a Social Security for All plan would keep U.S. citizens out of poverty. America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, will tell us why New Jersey Senator Cory Booker has ruined his chance of becoming the next Democratic superstar. Michael Brooks from the Majority Report will be here to run down some of the biggest news stories of the past week. Hey, if you aren't a member of our podcast, go to rofpodcast.com to sign up. You'll have the option of signing up for a free hour of our show or becoming a member and getting the three-hour show without commercials. Plus bonus content you won't hear anywhere else. Go to rofpodcast.com and sign up. That's rofpodcast.com. You're going to need independent media during the Trump years, and we'll be here. And don't forget, you can now gift the Ring of Fire podcast to a friend or family member. It's a great way to support independent progressive media. Joining me to run down the news of the week is my co-host here at Ring of Fire Radio and host of the new show, America's Lawyer, Mike Papantonio. So, Pap, now we have an official President Trump, as it were. I'm still going to refer to him as the president electoral out of consideration of his win. But next up, we start thinking about 2018 and 2020 and in terms of electoral politics. But one of the things, obviously, is talking about Democrats both not only fighting Trump, but also presenting a proactive view of a political vision. And part of that is, you know, fighting Trump on the ACA and pushing for single-payer expansion. But, you know, just a week and a half ago, not even, we had guys like Cory Booker, who has been positioning for 2020, who in the past I think people have been rather dubious about because of his relationships with Wall Street and with the school privatization movement. And he gave us, maybe it was a little bit over a week ago, but I don't know if we talked about it, a perfect example of what is problematic with a guy like Cory Booker, who does a great job going and arguing against Jeff Sessions as attorney general, important to put that marker down. But then the next night, in the dead of the night, votes against, granted, non-binding resolution, but an amendment that would have called for reimportation of Canadian drugs. He joins 11 other Democrats who voted against it, but he came from one of the bluest states. And, of course, they all had something in common, these 12 Democrats.
Well, let me make a prediction. Cory Booker is yesterday's news. He's a train wreck. You know, the theory is, yeah, I do something stupid, but people are going to forget. We won't let this forget. Nobody's going to forget what Cory Booker did here. Nobody is. The social media is killing him. Yeah. I mean, he is a dead man walking. And you know what? That's a good thing, because you'd rather deal with it now. They were trying to make Cory Booker into the next Obama and this great visionary. Yeah, you know, Cory Booker goes and talks about Sessions. I mean, who's not going to agree with him? I mean, Cory Booker's always out on these issues that are just, you know, nobody's going to disagree with, because it doesn't cost him any money. But the issue dealing with drugs and being able to let mom and pop buy drugs rather than, you know, paying a 3,000% markup, just having it shipped in from Canada. Cory Booker lines up with the fat cats that have put him where he is now. You have to go back and understand Cory Booker. Cory Booker was invented by Wall Street. Sam. He was totally invented by Wall Street. He's up there in pharmaceutical heaven where all the big pharmaceutical companies are. They invented Cory Booker. And so they say to Cory Booker, well, now make sure, Cory, that you're out on the touchy-feely issues about social issues, like whether it's, you know, whether it's race or whether it's gender. Make sure you're out there on that. But, buddy, when it comes to the money shots, you want our $300,000 that we give you from the pharmaceutical industry, so don't vote against us. And let me tell you how outrageous, I'm just so enraged by this. You have people out there that are deciding, should I buy my medication or should I pay my rent? Right. Should I buy medication or do I eat tonight? Should I be able to cut my pill in half so I can make it go twice the distance? Cory Booker knows that. And his argument about, oh, gee whiz, we had to be sure that we were going to get safe products. Really? Really? Is there some epidemic in Canada that nobody's told me about where people are dying from pharmaceuticals that haven't been tested? Cory Booker is a fraud. And Cory Booker is a fraud, Sam, and we got to keep talking about Cory Booker, the fraud, because I don't want him to gain any momentum. I want him to be yesterday's news. I don't care if he's a senator up in New Jersey. I don't care. Let him stay there, but do not put this dangerous character on a national field.
And you know, we should just remind people that about 2 weeks ago, he voted for the Cures Act, which sounds great. But really what it does is it says we should spend money on cancer. We should spend money on a couple other diseases. It doesn't appropriate the money. The money may never get there. But what it also did is it relaxed standards. And you know this as well as anybody, Pap. It basically relaxed standards in terms of FDA safety, which you know is already Swiss cheese as it stands now, because you've got basically the industry doing their own reports. So if he was really concerned about drug safety in this country, he wouldn't be relaxing standards for the FDA 1 week and then the next week pretending that somehow Canada was like some type of backroom chemistry lab, and we'd be getting all sorts of freaky stuff from Canada. But this is important. I mean, look, this is important. There's a couple of things that we can glean from this. I mean, aside from obviously specifically a guy like Cory Booker, keep an eye on Bob Casey as well, who voted this way, about 10 other Democrats who come from states that, you know.
Sam, I called Murray. I called both Murray and Casey because I wanted to see. We're going to do a show on them. On America's Lawyer on RT. And I said, look, send me something to defend what you've done. Mm-hmm. I haven't gotten anything from them. But I am going to absolutely decimate Cory Booker, Cantwell, Carper, Casey, Coons, Donnelly, Heinrich, Heitenkamp, all of these frauds. They know they have put mom and pop America in the position of, do I eat or can I buy my medication? And they're well aware of the fact that the Pfizer's and the Merck's and the Johnson & Johnson and the Bayer's, that they have marked up their products as high, in some instances, this is an unbelievable, as high as 6,000% on some of these medications. They know that, and they did this anyway. They don't deserve to be there with a big D behind their name. I don't have any confidence in Democrats to begin with, but they at least are trying to hide behind something that at least is a plausible argument that, gee whiz, I care for people. These people don't care for people. They care about money, and Cory Booker is all about money. We have got to stop the Cory Bookers before they completely destroy the only other party we have running right now besides the Republicans. I don't really care for either one of them, but you have to have at least two parties, and you're going to have Cory Booker decimate the Democratic Party because the discussions out there go online. He's already getting murdered in social media.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more about healthcare we saw this past week. Aside from Donald Trump taking the oath of the presidency, we saw a huge pushback by Democrats across the country over the past week and a half, fighting back against possible repeal of the Affordable Care Act. We'll also talk about President Obama's reauthorization of the National Defense Authorization Act, which had a little bonus in there for Donald Trump. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Pap, who has launched a new show on RT America called America's Lawyer. You can find out more at ringoffireradio.com. So, Pap, we were talking about Cory Booker and his betrayal of the Democratic Party and all the people who I think see him as some type of champion in refusing to allow for drug importation from Canada. But let's talk about a little bit about what Bernie Sanders had going on with the Our Revolution's Our First Fight, Our First Stand, I should say, where you had rallies organized by Bernie Sanders and like-minded folk, Our Revolution, across the country, scaring the heck out of Republican lawmakers when it came to the Affordable Care Act repeal. And the Republicans are in a bit of a box here because Donald Trump is going out there shooting his mouth off without knowing any of the details, promising things that would be great if he delivers, frankly, but basically writing checks that the Republican Party can't cash. And so they're completely confused as to where to go next. And well, it's a fascinating development.
Yeah, it is. It's there's fascinating on so many levels. First of all, that Bernie Sanders is doing what he said he was going to do.
Yep.
He promised that he wasn't going to go away. He promised that he's going to keep the discussions about things like healthcare alive. He's doing it. He's one of these few politicians that, you know, when he says something, Sam, you can really believe it. He does it. And here's what I find interesting about it. Just weeks ago, when we had the Republicans and Democrats trying to gut the ethics committee. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What changed their mind was political outrage. Everybody in the streets, just total outrage. It wasn't in the streets, but it was in social media, and they embarrassed the Democrats and the Republicans who were trying to make it to where there is no ethics. There's no such thing as an ethics violation anymore. Okay, that's what they were trying to do. Then we have the Cory Booker issue where he's lying to, we're seeing him as a fraud and he's committing fraud, and social media is responding and it'll continue picking up heat there. Now we have the health care issue. All of this, if you go back and think about it, has been driven by what Bernie Sanders has made his pledge, keeping this revolution alive, to say there is no Democrat that's correct. There is no Democratic hero. There's no Republican hero. We simply have to call balls and strikes. And right now, that's what's happening with Bernie in the health care fight. I mean, this could pick up real momentum.
Yeah, and it's good. And certainly, I think the Republicans are they're chasing their own tail. We've got Health and Human Services, Tom Price, this past week said that he has not shared his plan. He doesn't want to flaunt his plan in his hearings. And simultaneously, the administration claiming that they have not included him in their plans to redesign or supposedly replace the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
But just absurd.
He's out there saying insurance for everyone. A car in every, two cars in every garage.
Listen, if we have insurance for everybody and deductibles are low,
he will be,
and
the,
it's
he,
real insurance,
oh, the,
God bless.
God bless him. He will never go away as a great American leader if that happens.
Indeed. All right. Now let's talk a little bit about some parting gifts that President Obama left for Donald Trump. One was the NSA basically allowed for, via executive action, my understanding, that the NSA can now share raw intelligence across the spectrum of intelligence agencies just in time for Donald Trump and his organization to take over. But that's not all. Tell us about this NDAA provision.
Oh, my God. That's nothing compared to what Obama did two nights before Christmas while you were out drinking eggnog. Hopefully with, drinking eggnog or maybe asleep, you had Obama on his, by executive order, signing into law something that is Section 2349 of the it's the Defense Authorization Bill, which, you know, it gives money to the defense. Okay, so we can pay for military. So what he did is created what is nothing less than a ministry of propaganda. Where what they do is they have the right to spend, the Department of Defense, Sam, has the right to spend $60 million spreading it out among people in social media that will attack anybody who has a criticism of government. In other words, RT is a great example. I do a show on RT called America's Lawyer. So if I say something about Wall Street, this Ministry of Propaganda has the right to come after me, spend money with places like maybe the Washington Post or Huffington Post or wherever they want to spend the money to do a hit story on me. They've already done it with Ed Schultz. They've done it with Tom Hartman. So we're going to start seeing it more and more. But Obama gave us that, Sam. Obama signed it just in time for Trump to take over. Now, he hasn't said one word about it, not one word, but is the go. I urge everybody, go online and look at this. Just look up Obama's Ministry of Propaganda. You will be shocked. He knew what he was doing. He's a constitutional lawyer himself, taught constitutional law. He just says what we're going to do is now is allow the government to engage in propaganda, and we're going to make the decision on what's acceptable and not and is not acceptable about what somebody says about the U.S. government or Wall Street or pharmaceutical industry or fracking or whatever it may be. They're going to make the choice, and they're going to my prediction is a lot of money is going to go to the Washington Post, a lot of it's going to go to Huffington Post, a lot of it's going to go to any Amazon, anything that Bezos is involved with, because Bezos, as you know, has a huge government contract on computer security. So we're going to see all kinds of ugly things coming out of this. That's something that's part of Obama's legacy, and I'm not going to let that go. I'll be talking about that all of 2017, reminding this guy what he did in his last days in office.
Well, we're out of time, Pap. I'm sure you will be reminding everybody, and I appreciate it. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, why the media needs to adapt during the Trump presidency or get steamrolled like they did in the general election. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Mainstream media's coverage of the general election could be classified as dismal at best. Time after time, Donald Trump was able to go unchallenged on lies and outrageous statements. Joining us now to talk about his piece in the American Prospect, "The News Media Has Got to Change or It'll Get Steamrolled by Trump," Paul Waldman. So, Paul, you've written a piece, and we're starting to see, you know, there's been a decent number of pieces like this, because the relationship of the press to the president, the now president in this instance, and the American public, it's probably never been more important. Let's start with that premise. Why is it so important that the press gets this right?
Well, because I think that, this has been obviously an extraordinary election where we have a candidate who really kind of broke all the rules, and oftentimes in ways that showed that that everything that we thought was true wasn't true. If you think about it from Trump's perspective for a moment, he probably thinks, and quite rightly to a great degree, that he can get away with anything, and that everything that people thought was true just doesn't apply to him. That not only things like the mechanics of campaigning, that you don't have to have a real ground operation, for instance, you don't have to have a complex campaign structure. You know, people said, oh, that would really be a problem for him, and it turned out it wasn't. He could just blow into town, have a big rally, and that would be enough. And it turned out that you could be abusive to the news media and they wouldn't really punish you for it. It turned out that he didn't really need to air a lot of campaign ads. It turned out that you could lie just promiscuously dozens of times every day. And even if the press pointed it out, it wouldn't really make that much of a difference. So all of these things that we thought were true turned out not to be true. And I think that, the news media was really shocked. And that's, I think, one of the best explanations that I've seen for the disparate treatment that Trump and Clinton got. The way that Clinton was hammered in a much more damaging way by the news media than Trump was. So what some people have suggested is that, journalists really thought that when it came to Trump, they would certainly give him what could be considered negative coverage, but it was a lot of just sort of about this crazy show that he was putting on. Whereas with Clinton, they thought they were really vetting the person who was going to be the president. And so they were much more serious about the criticisms that they made of her and the way that they kind of hammered again and again and again on the emails, because they, they thought, assumed, as everyone did, and I'll admit I did too, that in the end she was going to win. So now we're left at this situation where, all of these things that the press thought it was doing just weren't really effective when it came to things like correcting his misinformation. And so now we're confronted with an administration that is probably going to continue to, upend the norms that governed how Washington operated, and they may have to find new ways of doing things in order to make sure that they are informing the public and not being distracted by the kind of insanity of the show that the Trump administration will no doubt be in the same way that the Trump campaign was.
I want to get to your prescriptions here, or at least your caveats to the press. But to what extent, though, was that dynamic also a function of the failure in the general election of Clinton making it about something other than Donald Trump as a freak and whatnot? And I would say even the Republican primary people, although part of the reason why they had trouble to make it something different is because fundamentally there wasn't a huge amount of daylight on issues between them and Trump, at least none that they wanted to talk about. And so how much of it is a function of incumbent upon the Democrats now to set the parameters in some way in the way that Trump is critiqued?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. In retrospect, we can see what the weaknesses in Clinton's strategy were. And one of the things that she didn't do was to use what has always been the most effective argument for Democrats, which is that the Republican Party is a party that is on the side of the rich and is doing things that will help rich people.
Right.
Clinton campaign made a calculation that they would be able to pull over moderate Republicans if instead of that they argued basically that, like, this guy is crazy,
right,
and that he's unfit and, he shouldn't be let anywhere near the nuclear codes and all of those things. So they made a calculation that was going to be more effective. There was more to be gained by trying to pull over those moderate Republicans than there was in making that kind of traditional Democratic argument. It turned out in the end that didn't work, that Republicans stayed with their candidate. At the time, it seemed like a perfectly reasonable strategy. It also seemed reasonable when, for long stretches, the Clinton campaign basically decided that they were going to let Donald Trump dominate the news on the theory that he was only going to hurt himself when he was on the front pages every day saying the latest outrageous thing. At the time, that seemed pretty smart because he looked so crazy and his approval ratings were so low. But in the end, we can look back and say that was probably a mistake, that they could have been making that argument. And in the end, she said a bunch of different things about him, and he had one very coherent argument to make, this idea of making America great again. You may disagree with it, but it was simple, easy to understand. It told a story about what was wrong with the country and where he wanted to take it. And
I don't want to relitigate the Clinton thing too much. I also think that, the calculation wasn't just that it was the best way to win. They wanted to fashion a win because they were looking past the election. I think there's some evidence for that in terms of Chuck Schumer going around in October talking about Paul Ryan, Hillary Clinton, and Chuck Schumer, spoke about himself in the third person, are going to make a big, more or less a grand bargain on tax repatriation and corporate tax and whatnot. But let's leave that aside for a moment. What does it tell us that Democrats need to do? If it was the case that for whatever reason Hillary Clinton followed an incorrect strategy in trying to defeat Donald Trump, what is that message sent to Democrats today? How much of that has to be, they also have to be involved. And I want to get to what you've suggested, because I think it's very important. But I wonder how much do Democrats have to set the parameters around politics? And maybe in some instances, Bernie Sanders going around saying, I would love it if Donald Trump kept his promise and we all get health insurance and deductibles are basically gone. That would be great. I mean, in terms of ultimately defeating Donald Trump and the Republicans and having them at war with each other, which would certainly help. How much do Democrats have a responsibility to set the tenor, at least of the coverage, to help the press who can't seem to help themselves?
Yeah, well, the analogy with what the administration is going to be doing in governing is that instead of continuing to argue that Donald Trump is a nut or he's unbalanced or he's going to, you know, do crazy things, the argument that they can make is, here's what the effect is on your life of the things that they are now doing. And so it's a much more kind of practical set of arguments. So instead of, you know, like this is Donald Trump's latest crazy tweet, you know, Democrats might do a lot better. And we're seeing that right now to argue that they're about to take health coverage away from 20 million people.
Right.
And now that the Republicans have control of government, they can no longer escape accountability. The things that they're going to do are actually going to affect people's lives. And so that I think is going to end up being the most fruitful avenue for Democrats, because, you know, it's easy for Republicans to say, oh, you know, Obamacare is terrible, and to kind of spin their way to advantage when they don't have to be responsible for any of the decisions they make. But you can get a certain distance with spin, but when you take someone's health insurance away, you can't convince them that they now have something terrific.
Indeed.
You know, there's kind of a practical reality on the ground that Republicans are now responsible for. And
all
I
right,
think
well,
that Democrats would do best to focus on those things, the actual effects of their policies.
All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, let's talk about then once that table is set, how the press should go about their job, because I think they're already learning that this is not going to be business as usual. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Paul Waldman. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Paul Waldman from the American Prospect about his piece, The News Media Has to Change or It'll Get Steamrolled by Trump. So, Paul, in the last segment we were talking about what the Democrats have to do in terms of dealing with Donald Trump, particularly in terms of creating a playing field, I guess, that is different from the one that the campaigns against him failed on, which was take it from the personal of Donald Trump being a lunatic and being an incompetent, all of which I think is a fair assessment in my mind, but take it to the implications of people's lives. In other words, politics. I mean, what real politics when it has an impact on people. But you also talk about the press and what job they got to do. So you talk about some assumptions that the press always has in dealing with the president that they may do best by jettisoning. Specifically, let's start with this. Direct questioning is a way to hold the president accountable. That's an assumption reporters have had, but you think that might not be operative.
Yeah, we saw this in Donald Trump's first press conference, you know, for a long time. And I'll admit I was doing this too, saying, you know, he hadn't had a press conference since July. And how can a politician be held accountable if he doesn't stand up in front of reporters and get questioned on policy and about his actions and his words? And if you don't have the opportunity to do that, then he's kind of skating away without being held responsible. And when he finally decided to hold this press conference, one might have thought, okay, well, now there's going to be some accountability. But that press conference was, you know, yet another dumpster fire. And no one, I think, who watched that could come away feeling like he is now more accountable. You know, he got up there and told a bunch of lies and squabbled with members of the press. and delivered some of his usual word salads. And at the end of it, you have to say, well, what was the point of that? Like, what did that really accomplish for the public? And so I think that if you're a White House reporter or any reporter covering politics, you have to say, well, you know, maybe, yes, it can still be important if we have the chance to do interviews with him or to do a press conference, but we shouldn't assume that that's going to really accomplish very much. I mean, if you think back to the campaign, the reporters who really who did the most important work were oftentimes those who were far away from the candidate. You know, someone like David Farenthold of the Washington Post, who did all this great work on Trump's foundation and exposed it for the fraud that it was. Someone like Daniel Dale from the Toronto Star, who was on the trail with Trump and every night would take the transcript of his remarks and document every lie that he told and kept this kind of running tally. And so, you know, people who were doing all this important work, not because they, you know, they got to ask him a question shouted from across a room, but because they tried to be a little bit creative and said, you know, what can I accomplish if I really set my mind to it in something that everybody else isn't doing? Now, the problem with that, though, is that it's really hard, and reporters have deadlines every single day, and it's really easy to say, this is what the president said, and here's a response from Democrats, and that's the story of the day. And doing that kind of more entrepreneurial reporting is really hard, but I think it's going to be more important than ever in Trump's Washington.
Let me just refine that a little bit, too, and get your feeling on it, because I think you're absolutely right that there's this always this sense of, like, we get him in a press conference, we're going to have this gotcha moment where we catch him. With that, while I think that is wrong, and I think you're right that the real sort of work is to be done from afar, I have to say that now that we're moving into an era where Donald Trump, it's not just what the accountability comes insofar as he is actually now part of the government. And when he gets up there in that press conference 2 weeks ago and says, we're going to do a repeal and replace, and it may be within an hour of each other or a week, but we're certainly not going to let it hang out there. Within a day, Paul Ryan had to come out and say the exact same thing. Now, I don't know how long that's going to be in effect, but that certainly forced the Republicans, it seems to me, into a box. And I know you've written about that. And part of that comes from there, where the more mundane things, I think, where we have gotten used to politicians being circumspect in their public pronouncements of what they're going to do. It's one thing he gets away with it in the campaign because there's no testing it, right? But it's another when he actually says it as president and he has to bring along a Congress. But I don't know your feeling on that. But I got to say, I think stuff like that is going to prove to be more important as we go forward. But continue on. Access is critical. Another notion that reporters have had that you think is inoperative.
Yeah, I this is something that especially in the White House, you know, there's an assumption that the closer you can get, if you can have a source that's as close as possible to the president, then you'll get some information that is true and that other people don't have, and that will enable you to get a better story and get kind of the real story. But I don't think that, you know, that was always questionable. But it's especially problematic in Trump's White House. I don't think that you know, getting to have Reince Priebus tell you what the real skinny is going to really get information that is useful to your audience if you're a journalist. You're always going to get spun. And I think particularly in this White House where, you know, from the top down, there's just this assumption that you can say whatever you want. And it doesn't really matter if you say the complete opposite 24 hours later, that kind of, access journalism is just not going to yield very much that's very interesting or very revealing. I think that especially at a time when there's so much that's going to change, you know, Republicans have been waiting for 8 years to undo the Obama presidency, and there's going to be dramatic things happening everywhere, that, I think it really, is incumbent upon reporters to not worry about whether or not, you know, that they're getting a blind quote from some White House staffer, but to actually go a little farther afield and figure out what the policies really turn out to be and how they're affecting people's lives. That's going to be a much more important story.
You also think that the press, and I agree with this as well, that they should jettison the idea of critiquing the spectacle as being important and follow every tweet with bated breath that the president puts out there. But with all of this said, isn't the big constraint here on journalists, to a certain extent, simply capitalism? I mean, from my perspective, I watch cable news. They're covering Donald Trump 24/7 through the campaign. But once he wins, those rallies become a lot less appealing to the viewers because he's no longer a freak show. He's actually the president. Well, how do you think that the journalists are going to be able to do what is seems to me, a much more sober, a much more difficult in many respects, and perhaps a lot less clickable job going forward?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that happened this year is that because it was a freak show, the cable networks made a lot of money, and they found out that it was very lucrative to just stick a camera in the back of a Trump rally. And so at the same time as they were talking amongst themselves and saying that this guy is incredibly dangerous, it was also boosting their profits. Mm. And this is the perennial challenge of journalism, frankly. You know, I do think that there are ways, if you're creative enough, to do good journalism and have it be appealing to people and still make money. I mean, I write for The Washington Post, which is a profitable newspaper that has been growing and hiring staff, and I think had the best coverage of any news outlet of this campaign in America. And I'm not really a decision maker there. I'm just sort of stating my own opinions in print. But I think that that you know it shows that it's at least possible to assemble and build an audience while doing plenty of serious journalism. It's sometimes it's hard to do, and you're probably not going to find too much of it on cable news, unfortunately.
Paul Waldman, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Paul Waldman is a weekly columnist and senior writer for the American Prospect. He also writes for the Plumline blog at the Washington Post and The Week, and is author of Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. When we come back, Michael Brooks, contributor to the Majority Report and host of Two Dope Boys in a Podcast, will join us to run down the news of the week. And if you missed any part of this show, go to rofpodcast.com, sign up for our free one-hour podcast. And if you want the full show, without commercials, become a member. Your support is what helps keep Ring of Fire on the air. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Hey, if you're just joining us, you can catch the first hour of our show by becoming a member to our podcast. You'll get our three-hour show, commercial-free, plus bonus content you can't find anywhere else. Just go online to rofpodcast.com to sign up. Joining me now, Michael Brooks, contributor to my daily show, The Majority Report, and co-host of Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. So, Michael, one of the... we've got to celebrate good news where we find it. And this is actually, I don't know what else to call it. A nice story. And as you know, at the end of their term, presidents hand out commutations and pardons. President Obama has granted a record number of pardons and commutations. The actual number, escapes me at the moment, but it is... Of those commutations that he has granted was a commutation of Chelsea Manning's sentence, which was scheduled to go until 2045. Instead, she will be released on May 17th of this year. Senior administration official said the 120-day delay was part of the standard transition period for commutations to times served, and was designed to allow for such steps as finding a place for Mrs. Manning to live after her release. The Obama granted 63 pardons and 207 other commutations. That is pretty impressive. Chelsea Manning, I think it's widely sort of unexpected.
Yeah, it's definitely unexpected. And given, let's be real here, as I think, in some ways, obviously, we're going to appreciate President Obama more and more every day, warranted and unwarranted. And, you know, his overall record, obviously, on whistleblowers, on surveillance issues, and really on just sort of transparency in foreign policy and intelligence is, I mean, not great. It will actually be significantly altered, I think, by commuting this sentence. Maybe significantly is too strong a word, but I think it showed that in the end that, you know, President Obama, and, you know, and this is the type of area where we can actually sort of talk about him as an individual, his personality and his motives. And I think he is a pretty complex figure. And it seemed to me that I don't see a sort of policy pivot, because I think that the core argument about Manning is really whether or not you see her as a whistleblower or not. And I know that we see her, you know, that the things that she exposed were important. They were things that the public, you know, needed to know. It seems to me that this is also in some ways just an act of compassion, which became the kind of secondary or the follow-up issue with Chelsea Manning, was that even if you had disagreed with the leaks, how could you possibly defend how the military was treating her? I mean, you know, I believe the UN had acknowledged that her treatment in prison met definitions of torture. She was held in solitary confinement. And so I think that, you know, President Obama obviously has at least evened out somewhat his legacy by doing this. And that's an important thing.
Yeah, I don't know if evened out is necessarily.
Maybe
I
mean, somewhat is the big caveat, not policy-wise, but symbolically and historically.
There are a lot of whistleblowers who are in prison.
Right.
I mean, I think the case of Chelsea Manning was, frankly, an extreme one.
Yes.
In terms of deserving a commutation, if not simply because of the crime that she was convicted of committing, was, you know, arguably whistleblowing, as opposed to a criminal act. But she was, by all accounts, severely mistreated.
Severely.
Was subject to an extended, prolonged period of solitary confinement, which is, by international law, considered torture.
Yeah.
And she was punished for attempting to commit suicide. And so I think on those grounds alone, because of the severe mistreatment by the U.S. military of Chelsea Manning, she deserved a commutation. And there is some question, or I should say, some people have asked whether or not Donald Trump, as president, because he's expressed, frankly, skepticism about commutations, and particularly with Chelsea Manning in the past, whether he has the ability to come in and undo a commutation. Now, he can, this is according to experts in the Marshall Project, he can undo a significant number of executive orders that President Obama had made during his 8 years in office. And that includes things like, you know, tightening background checks,
environmental regulations.
Yes,
yeah, like that.
Banning certain questions on federal job applications, solitary confinement of juveniles and federal prisoners. Those can be overturned. However, my understanding is, in terms of commutations or clemency, that Trump cannot reverse commutations, because this is a due process issue. But Trump could certainly stop issuing commutations and pardons if he wanted, but he cannot go back on grounds that have already been covered.
Yeah, unless they're people that were involved in maybe like a certain organized structures in New York City. He probably wouldn't be too interested in commuting anybody's sentence.
Right, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, you got what I'm saying.
Well, Joey No Socks may get a break. And we should also add that it wasn't just Chelsea Manning who received a commutation, a notable one. And there was frankly, some notable people left off the list.
Yeah, I think Leonard Peltier is someone that I think about a lot, Native American activist who I think was convicted of a crime that there's a lot of questions around the 1970s. Don Siegelman is someone also... who should be on the list, but he did release...
Governor from Alabama, and I believe Siegelman is slated to be released this year. So I don't know if that had any bearing on it or what, but I think he should have had it, frankly, gotten a pardon. But
and he did release Oscar Lopez Rivera, who was a Puerto Rican nationalist, and I think what was it was he was offered actually a deal years ago in the Clinton administration.
At the end of the Clinton administration, he was offered a deal to have his sentence commuted, I think, to 10 years from then. Right now, if he was not if he was not commuted now, he would have been in until 2023. But Bernie Sanders advocated strongly on Oscar Lopez Rivera's behalf. So it is an incredibly humane act. Incredibly humane. It's a humane act.
It's a humane act.
And I am thankful it doesn't fundamentally alter the arc of Obama's presidency. But it does show a certain level of humanity. And frankly, it is in my mind, at least, you know, sort of one positive in a week which has been less than positive as we get a notion of what the future is going to look like now with a fully inaugurated President Trump. All right, look, we got to take a break. We'll be right back with more. I'm Sam Cedar. Michael Brooks is joining me from the Majority Report. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio.
We were staying in Paris to get away from your parents, and I thought, wow, if I could take this in a shot right now, I don't think that we could work this out on a terrace. I don't know if it's fair, but I thought, how could I let you fall by yourself? Well, I'm wasted with someone else. If we go down, then we go down
together. We are back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, here with the co-host of Two Dope Boys in a Podcast and a contributor to my daily show, The Majority Report, Michael Brooks. So President Obama, basically, we just, in the last segment, we were talking about his last act as president, or I should say, most lasting one, the commutations and pardons. And, of course, now we are in a new era. And in the next segment, we should talk about, on the next hour, we'll talk about some of the hearings of this week, the Tom Price hearing and the Pruitt standout. Of course, we've already spoken, we'll be talking about Betsy DeVos later in this hour. Just this week, the AP came out with a report about the gap between the super rich in the world and the poorest half of the global population. This is just stunning. And in some respects, well, why don't you just tell the results of the story? And then,
I mean, it's one sentence, right? Oxfam says 8 men as rich as half of the world. That's the main takeaway. There's no elaboration.
It is crazy. Bill Gates, Michael Bloomberg, 6 others owning as much wealth as 3.6 billion people in the world. Now, we also had this week, we saw at least a couple of billionaires who are in hearings over the past 2 weeks for Trump's administration. But this is unbelievable. They presented their findings at the Swiss ski resort of Davos.
That's kind of part of what is really interesting and troubling in some respects about how even sometimes these studies are framed. So, you know, they quote Mark Lawson, who's an Oxfam policy advisor and, you know, doing God's work, no criticism of Oxfam or him. And I understand where he's unveiling the results and everything else, but he urged billionaires to quote unquote, do the right thing. And, you know, follow Bill Gates in paying their taxes. And the thing is that when you have a problem that is this structural and really does reveal the inherent dangers of capitalism unchecked, because this is what it leads to. If you don't check capitalism, you lead to market monopolies and you lead to massive inequalities.
And political inequalities. I mean, you go from a plutonomy to a plutocracy.
To a plutocracy, and it is not dependent on the personal ethics of any of these people. I mean, we can have a conversation where we can say, you know, I would prefer that, you know, Warren Buffett be a billionaire than Betsy DeVos. That is no policy answers come from personal moral assessments or even public performance assessments of these people.
And the amazing thing is, too, is that what's sort of shocking is that the report is reported to these billionaires as if, like, it's really up to your largesse.
Yes.
Right? Like, we're like, they are so powerful that it's almost the sort of subtext of this is like, there's no point in the rest of us debating this because it's really going to come down. And this is part of the problem. This is indicative of the problem that at the end of the day, it's really up to you. I mean, this is why, right? I mean, fundamentally, the idea of simply of taxation as a means in which to promote equality is not enough. There has to be structural, like you say, structures put in place in societies to prevent the accumulation of this type of wealth. I mean, that is, and it's not, I'm not saying that there needs to be a law that says like you can't earn past X amount of dollars. But I think there has to be laws that prevent monopolies, that prevent predatory practices, that tax these gains before they can multiply in such a fashion to prevent something like this amount of disparity. The idea that you've got 3.6 billion people who own the same wealth as eight is just obscene, and nobody can think this is a good idea.
It's obscene. Well, that's the other problem that we're in right now, right? Is that I think that we're seeing, just as there's been sort of this transition in politics of kind of like, you know, if you think of the 90s, the sort of soft, gauzy kind of neoliberalism of people like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, even though it wasn't all that soft and in practice. But, you know, we see differences, and this is maybe where some of those moral and policy differences do matter, of, you know, people who hold a obscene and illogical amount of resources and money, who at least can kind of abstractly acknowledge and engage with the problem. Now we have, you know, the empowerment of the Peter Thiels of the world, who would be the only person, only people listening to this who would say, it's completely not a problem. This is actually right. And we should just have, like, a new postmodern form of, like, what was it, the great chain of being from feudalism. There's a natural descending order of hierarchy and right and good. And now it's not about birth, although actually functionally it is. It's just about money and assets. And if you have it, you're good.
And I mean, that plays out in a couple of different ways. There was a piece in the New York Times about women who voted for Trump in their own words. And we don't have too much time to go through it, but one woman,
they were beautiful words.
Yeah, one woman, a 48-year-old woman, said, Trump's not a perfect man by any means. He kind of reminds me of my ex-husband. I think he's a really good man deep down. This guy has such potential, and I truly believe he cares about our country and wants to help everyone. Now, you know, that to me is a function of someone who has been taught over and over again, primarily by the Republican Party, but broadly speaking, our society, that having money equals being morally righteous.
Right.
Because there is no piece of evidence that one could point to, objectively speaking, saying that Donald Trump deep down is a good man.
That's ironically, Donald Trump is one of the most transparent, not only people, just things we have in modern life.
He is
a horrible deep
from
down.
Charities.
Yes.
He has been accused of rape. He has been accused
scam
by,
university.
Of assault. He's been accused by over a dozen women now of molestation. He has been accused by the Justice Department and found guilty of racial discrimination. I mean, I could go on and on. Short of actually killing anybody, I don't see how he could be perceived as a great man deep down inside, unless you're looking at wealth. But we've got to take a break. We'll be back in the next hour to talk about some of the also less than great men that Donald Trump has nominated to be in his cabinet. We get a quick break. Sam Seder, Ring of Fire Radio. I'm here with Michael Brooks from the Majority Report. We'll be back in the next hour. Just ahead, Zoe Carpenter from The Nation magazine will fill us in on the disaster that was Betsy DeVos's Senate confirmation hearing for Secretary of Education. I'm Sam Seder. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Earlier in the week, Betsy DeVos had her confirmation hearing for the Secretary of Education. When the hearing was over, it would be safe to say she failed to answer some of the most basic education questions facing our country. Here to recap what happened during the hearings is the Associate Washington Editor for The Nation magazine, Zoe Carpenter. So, Zoe, you write about Betsy DeVos as a crusader against public education, and the use of crusader does a lot of work in that title, I think, for a couple of reasons. But give people a sense of who Betsy DeVos is.
Well, Betsy DeVos is a billionaire from Michigan, and she's become one of the most prominent Republican donors, not only in Michigan, but across the country. She and her husband have donated hundreds of millions of dollars by some estimates to various right-wing candidates and causes over the years. And, she, you know, her family hasn't attracted as much attention as, say, the Koch brothers, but they've had a similar influence at the local and national level.
And she actually sits on the board of ALEC and has given fund. I mean, like you say, I mean, her name shows up just about everywhere. And in fact, during the hearings, Bernie Sanders said that she had given millions of dollars. What was it, $200 million to Republican causes, I think it was? And she said possibly as a family.
That's correct. And not only has she given that money, but in an interview in the late 90s, she spoke of conceding the fact that she expected certain things in return for that money. So she's been very clear that not only is she donating, but she expects that her donations will have political impact. And specifically, her interest has been in the area of education around, quote unquote, education reform, although she's also been involved in anti-union efforts, for example.
All right. Well, give us a sense. What does the Secretary of Education do? Because I don't know if people understand what the federal role in education is in this country and what exactly the portfolio a Secretary of Education would run.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the Secretary of Education oversees implementation and enforcement of policies relating to K through 12 education and to higher education. So in terms of higher education, the Secretary oversees a $1 trillion student loan program and a $30 billion Pell Grant program. So it's quite a lot of financial oversight. And then in terms of K through 12, she would be responsible for implementing the recently passed overhaul to No Child Left Behind, responsible for enforcing protections for disabled students, and a variety of other civil rights functions related to the department.
So, all right. So in terms of like K through 12, so I guess there's three major areas, right? There is making sure there are some basic standards in terms of the rights of students that runs across the country. There is the financial implications of higher education and providing some type of funding mechanism for it. On that other part from K through 12, I mean, like, where does local and state control end, or where does and federal influence, where do they meet? I mean, when we talk about implementing No Child Left Behind, what is actually involved in something like that? And I guess they call it now Race to the Top. What's involved in implementing that?
So according to legislation that was passed last year, that actually put more power back in control of the states. So questions about the expansion of charter schools and the oversight of charter schools, for example, are really controlled by the states. There are certain federal standards that all states are supposed to meet. You probably have heard of Common Core, and that would be an example of that. But in terms of, you know, how much testing to do, that's more left up to the states.
And so we talk about her agenda here. I just want to throw in this quote from a 2001 interview, which was for The Gathering. I guess this is a group that was focused on advancing Christian faith through philanthropy. And when she was asked as to whether or not that philanthropic dollars could be remain the primary source for expanding Christian education in this country, she replied, "There are not enough philanthropic dollars in America to fund what is currently the need in education versus what is currently being spent every year on education in this country." The remaining of that, of course, would be primarily public taxpayer dollars. "Our desire is to confront the culture in ways that will continue to advance God's kingdom." So she is, her agenda here is not simply a straight privatization one, it seems to me. There's also this sort of a very healthy or unhealthy, I guess, depending on your perspective, agenda involving parochial schools. But tell us a little bit about her involvement before we get into that, her involvement in the city of Detroit in particular, in Michigan, more broadly speaking, in terms of education.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in Michigan overall, one of the big changes came in 1983 when DeVos helped to underwrite a bill that opened up the state to the charter school industry. And one of the cities in which charter schools moved quickly into was Detroit. But what happened in Detroit is that the charter schools tended to cluster in wealthier neighborhoods, so it didn't really solve the problem with giving the poorest, most disadvantaged students better options. And the other thing that happened with the charter schools in Detroit is that because Michigan has some of the lowest accountability standards in terms of what happens when charter schools don't perform well, it meant that many of the schools that came into Detroit and other Michigan cities actually didn't perform any better than traditional public schools in the state. And so what we see now is that since 1993, when that charter explosion kicked off, Michigan's educational attainment, if you measure it by standardized tests across a variety of grades, has actually fallen pretty significantly. And Detroit is now often referred to as a quote-unquote Wild West for education because there's so little accountability for schools. And it's so bad that even other advocates of charter schools have distanced themselves from DeVos and the Detroit example.
All right. You know, I want to dig deeper into this whole notion of accountability because this came up during your hearings. And let's take a break. And when we come back in a moment, I'd like to talk about those hearings because there were a couple of really stunning moments when under questioning Betsy DeVos showed in many respects just how little interest she seems to have in what educators talk about when they talk about education from a policy standpoint, and also just how little experience she has in the other areas of this education secretary portfolio, and not to mention, like you say, accountability, particularly for federal regulations across these different schools. So we're going to take a quick break. We will be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Zoe Carpenter from The Nation magazine about Betsy DeVos, whose hearings took place this week for Secretary of Education. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire. We'll be right back. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to the Associate Washington Editor for The Nation magazine, Zoe Carpenter, about Betsy DeVos, President Trump's unqualified pick for Secretary of Education. So, Zoe, before the break, you gave us a brief rundown of who Betsy DeVos is. She was in front of the committee, the Education Committee, this week. There was not a lot of questioning allowed, really, was there, by the committee chair, Lamar Alexander?
No, it was a rushed hearing, and it was conducted under rather shady circumstances in the sense that it was largely an after-hours hearing. It didn't even begin until 5 p.m., and most committee members were only allowed one round of five-minute questions each. And that is somewhat against precedent when you consider that one of George W. Bush's nominees was questioned with 10-minute rounds of questions from senators. And when you consider the sort of exceptional record of DeVos in the sense that because she doesn't have a long professional history in education, there's a lot that's unknown about her positions on various issues. And so she's a candidate where more time would have been quite helpful.
And she also showed up in front of the committee without having her ethics reports filed.
That's correct. And that's also a concern because we already know that some of her investments are related to the student loan industry and some for-profit education businesses. And she has said that she'll comply with whatever arrangement the Office of Government Ethics asks her to. But we really don't have a good understanding of how heavily she is tied into some of the industries that she'll be overseeing.
Why do you think the hearing was held at 5 p.m.? That I found rather perplexing. I mean, I imagine she's a billionaire. She's also from the by marriage, but also her family, her maiden family, I guess, was also quite wealthy. Her brother is Eric Prince, the chair of what was formerly known as Blackwater. Now I think it's Jay, or maybe they have a new name for it. But this is the mercenary force. Why at 5 p.m.? I mean, was this something so the parents couldn't watch? Was it something so that in the event they wanted to pretend like it had been going on for hours? What was that?
Well, all I can do is speculate. I think the reason that Republicans might offer is that initially the hearing was scheduled for last week during the daytime, but it was postponed because of complaints from Democrats that they hadn't had enough time to review her materials and that her ethics questionnaire was not complete. And so they might argue that because they had to move the hearing, this was the only time that was available that didn't conflict with other Senate business. Of course, a slightly more cynical but plausible view is that they moved it to a time when they thought few people would be watching because they were worried that she wouldn't be prepared, which is indeed how she came across during that hearing.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Senator Al Franken asked her a question, which for people who are involved, and she claims she's been involved in education policy, I guess, for 30 years. And he asked her a question that seemed to utterly confuse her. And it was a fascinating exchange where he was asking her opinion on a very prominent debate in education circles, particularly education policy circles, not so much actual teaching per se, but arguably in the way that schools and teachers are evaluated. Tell us what that was and why that was so stunning.
Sure. First, I just want to point out that although she may have those 30 years of experience, it's only as a lobbyist or advocate and as a donor. I think it's helpful to understand that she has never formally studied education. She's never taught. She's never worked in a school administration or in any kind of government department that oversees education. So her experience is just as, an outside lobbyist, essentially.
And I don't even get the sense. Let me just add one more editorial point. I don't get the sense that she's even talked to people about these issues. I mean, this was stunning. I mean, one would think even if you're just a military lobbyist, that you would actually have some conversations about broad military reform, issues with members of the military. I don't even think she's had those conversations.
It certainly seemed that way from the hearing. You know, when she was asked what lessons she would draw from her experience working in Detroit, she couldn't offer anything. She apparently had learned nothing from that experience. And meanwhile, there were busloads of students and parents from Detroit who had come to protest her nomination. So certainly there were several moments in which she seemed very out of touch with the students she claimed to be helping. But back to the Al Franken question, the argument that he was asking about was whether student achievement should be measured by growth or whether it should be measured by proficiency. And as you said, this is a very old and very common debate among educators and policymakers. One of the things that happened with the education reform movement is that we started more aggressively punishing teachers and schools based upon student proficiency, which is whether they can measure up to a certain standard at a given point in time. So, for example, whether they are at whatever is defined as third grade reading level. There's another idea that we should measure student growth and that we should reward teachers and judge school performance based upon how much students grow during the course of a year or another time period. So that way you can sort of capture whether a student who comes in way below reading level has actually made progress and how much progress, rather than just the fact that they've still failed the test at the end of the year. So this is a really a critical question, and the fact that she couldn't seem to answer it and seemed confused about the distinction, that really says troubling things about her preparation for this role.
Yeah, I mean, I want to be clear here, right? People can have an opinion on this one way or another. I mean, I happen to think it's quite obvious that, you know, when you have tough inputs, it's going to impact your outputs in terms of educational efficacy. But to be unfamiliar with the terms and to be unfamiliar with this debate suggests to me that her involvement in education has been far more about just simply diverting funds than anything else. And in fact, like, that's what her major proposal seemed to be, right? Is vouchers and charters that essentially have very little oversight, this funneling of the taxpayer money. Just talk briefly about, and this came up with Senator Hassan and also with Senator Kaine, about the accountability standards and about her seemingly lack of awareness that federal law requires equal accountability standards.
Yeah, she was asked whether all schools that receive public money, regardless of whether they're charter schools or traditional public schools or private schools that students have obtained vouchers to attend, whether they should be required to meet certain requirements such as, accountability to student performance or disability requirements. And she generally refused to take a clear position on that, even saying at one point that she thought that meeting the disability requirements was a matter best left to the states. And that's really troubling because there is, in fact, a very major civil rights law called the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act, which is a federal law. And so either she was not familiar with the existence or the content of that major civil rights law, or she thinks that it's optional for states to comply with it, which either way is quite troubling.
Zoe, we just had about 50 seconds left. In your estimation, your experience, have we ever had an education secretary who was less suited for the role? I mean, just on a sheer sort of a resume on paper perspective in terms of experience in this realm?
I think the response from a variety of stakeholders in the education realm clearly indicates no. You see networks of charter schools, such as the charter school network in Massachusetts, who has come out with serious concerns about her nomination. Even senators, Democratic senators, who are broadly supportive of charter schools and some elements of school privatization are appalled by her. So what's really interesting here is that even people who agree with some of her privatization agenda are concerned about her lack of experience. So it's not just an ideological objection to her aims, but also to her basic unfitness.
Zoe Carpenter, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Zoe Carpenter is the Associate Washington Editor for The Nation magazine. You can read her piece, The Coming Crusade Against Public Education, at thenation.com. When we come back, Majority Report contributor Michael Brooks will be here to help run down more big stories from this past week. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Hey, if you're just joining us, catch the first hour of our show by becoming a member of our podcast. You get the full three-hour show, commercial-free, plus bonus content you can't find anywhere else. Just go online to rofpodcast.com to sign up. You will keep independent media alive. Back to help us run down the biggest news of the week, Michael Brooks, contributor to my daily show, The Majority Report, and co-host of Two Dope Boys and a Podcast. So, Michael, I just spoke to someone earlier in the program about Betsy DeVos, the really stunningly unqualified, and I don't say that lightly, stunningly unqualified billionaire who is seeking to be the Secretary of Education, who has, to the extent that her agenda is in any way obtuse, it is only because it's hard to know whether her primary agenda is to simply to destroy public schools or really to simply find a new funding mechanism for parochial schools. I actually think that she's most interested in funding mechanism for religious schools. But I think, you know, it's tough to parse those out. Now, meanwhile, we had two other amongst the other hearings we had this week, two other hearings where you had people appointed whose agendas were to fundamentally undermine the agency they were appointed to. And first off, I mean, who comes to mind in this way, in a way that I think is sort of unrivaled, is Scott Pruitt. He is the former attorney general from Oklahoma. He has been appointed to head the EPA. His primary, I guess, qualification to serve at the EPA has been his relentless attempts to stop the EPA from fulfilling its statutorily mandated role in protecting water and air. And as an attorney general from Oklahoma, it's almost an understatement to say in the pocket of big oil, because that gets his co-chair of his campaign was Henry Hamm, I think is his name, who is the president of a major fracking oil company. And this guy basically fought the Environmental Protection Agency and now is put at the head to basically fight off other litigation that is going to try and force the EPA to do their job. Meanwhile, among other things he said at his hearing this week, he said he's not going to recuse himself from the lawsuits he brought against the agency that are now going to be picked up by others. And he's supposedly going to defend the agency against those lawsuits. It's ridiculous.
I mean, I'm sort of straining to not make a cheap and obvious joke, so I'll half make it. But like, you know, putting a Russian in charge of like our nuclear arsenal, which you know, maybe we'll do something like that.
I honestly don't think that
wouldn't be as bad as this.
No,
but the contrast
that
strikes me with Betsy DeVos that's fascinating is that this is clearly a guy who actually does know his policy terrain quite well. He's a master of his brief. He's actually a very smart and relentless litigator and attorney general, all simply on behalf of dismantling, you know, and I think it's important. I mean, obviously the climate crisis is defining, but this is also the stuff that I think, like many other things that we're going to start to see come under siege in this administration, that people get complacent on because they take for granted. there has been certain improvements in terms of like what's allowed in your water, what's allowed in the paint for your building. You know, very basic stuff is going to be underplay with this guy as well. There is not even a point in any profile of him when they would even bend over backwards to look for, you know, he's pretty opposed to such and such in the EPA, but you know, here's this one policy
really
area where
strong he's strong on saving the spotted owl.
Yeah, he's throwing
like
a bone to a bone. No, not at all. This is a person, and I think in some ways, you know, we had Dan Dicker on the Majority Report. If you see it as part of a sort of whole global strategy that the Trump administration is bringing in, just sort of relentless opposition to any type of environmental cap on anything, and that we need to just pull and coal resources. And this is the leading attorney general in the country, you know, in the past on behalf of that agenda, now in charge of dismantling the EPA from within. I mean, there's really no other way to look at it.
Yeah, this guy is, I mean, just contemplate this for a moment. I can't get over this enough. He is going to be both the plaintiff and the defendant in cases against the EPA. In some respects, he's going to be the judge and jury. And this is a guy who is being brought in to dismantle the function of the EPA. He danced around a little bit in terms of climate change during the hearing. I think you got a quote of his, which was very sort of slippery. He said, science tells us the climate's changing and human activity in some manner impacts that change. The ability to measure with precision the degree and the extent of that impact and what to do about it are subject to continuing debate and dialogue, and well, it should be. In other words, I'm willing to concede that there are other people out there who believe that there is such a thing called climate change and that there is a debate, which, of course, is no concession at all.
And by the way, that is the most sophisticated form of, you know, energy industry
denial. Yes.
Propaganda. All of the other stuff sounds amateurish and crude and stupid compared to that. That's the policy formula that companies like Exxon and PR formula that they actually work to develop to simultaneously sound rational, open-minded, and fair while functionally continuing to accelerate the climate crisis.
What was also stunning was at one point, he was asked about the Flint, Michigan water crisis, about the damage that is done when you have those, we have children in particular, exposed to elevated levels of lead. Senator Ben Cardin from Maryland asked him this question specifically, what an acceptable level of lead consumption would be for children. And Pruitt's response, as you would imagine for someone who is about to take control of the primary vehicle for ensuring that Americans drink safe water, have access to safe water, drink safe water. Well, that's something I've not reviewed nor know about. I would be concerned about any level of lead going into drinking water, obviously human consumption, but I have not looked at the scientific research. And of course, we know why he hasn't, because his job is going to be to, as a lawyer, as someone who has litigated this, how do I fight back against lawsuits that are filed to require the EPA to do its statutory duty? Just stunning. I don't know. Again, you know, Democrats are in a huge disadvantage here. I imagine they're all going to vote against Scott Pruitt. I don't know if they're going to be able to stop him at all. That remains to be seen. But let's jump. Let's take a quick break. And when we head into the next segment, let's take a look at Tom Price, who was also in front of the Senate this week. He would be the incoming Health and Human Services Secretary. Of course, he is a well-known Tea Party congressperson who has a 5-point plan, I believe it is, to repeal and replace Obamacare. We will talk about the plan. We will talk about what he didn't talk about at the plan at the hearing. But what has overshadowed his plans to destroy our healthcare system is his past actions in profiting off our healthcare system. We'll be right back with more on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Michael Brooks from the Majority Report will join me on the other side.
you go to Montreal or hide behind the package store? You're hanging out with your old friends, and then knew you'd see the end. You're in so much trouble, you can't hide in the covers.
Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Cedar here with Michael Brooks from Two Dope Boys in a Podcast and contributor to my daily show, The Majority Report. So, Michael, in the last segment, we spoke about Scott Pruitt's hearings. He is the former attorney general from Oklahoma, our would-be secretary of the EPA. I will remind people it's called the Environmental Protection Agency. There is absolutely nothing on his agenda to protect the environment. His agenda is fully and, I think, unabashedly. I mean, I don't think he runs from this. To roll back and protect the corporations, the fossil fuel producers that are in any way inhibited by the EPA. I mean, I don't even think that's his. I don't even think he attempts to hide that. Meantime, almost while he was going through his hearing, Tom Price was getting, in my mind, just devastated by Senator Al Franken, among others, in his hearing. And not simply, and they, look, you know, we had talked about this on the Majority Report. The Trump administration, or I should say transition team, has supposedly kept him at arm's length, Tom Price, in the development of their replace plan for Obamacare. And I'm using air quotes because it's a joke. They don't have one. That's what makes it much easier to keep Tom Price away from it. Tom Price, of course, has his own plan. He didn't want to go into this hearing flaunting it, yeah, as it were. And, of course, there was very few questions allowed, and there was very little time. I think 7 minutes per senator was all that was granted in this hearing. And the senators were a little bit distracted by the enormous amount of corruption that Tom Price seems to have participated in.
Yeah, I mean, Tom Price has basically consistently sort of, you know, traded essentially in his own kind of private stock portfolio based off of votes he's taking. So he's basically, you know, taking a vote in Congress to benefit a company that he knows he will personally profit from. And that was their main focus on the hearing before they even got to his plan, which would take away coverage for people, not deal with pre-existing conditions. And also, maybe we get to it a bit later, in some ways completely contradicts what Trump says he wants to do about health care. It would almost be the equivalent, like if Trump personally said, my top priority is dealing with the climate crisis, and he nominated Pruitt. That's like a little bit of the dynamic going on with the Price nomination. But it seemed to me that the only response, it was kind of in some ways reminding me of the Jeff Sessions hearing when people called Jeff Sessions out on his abominable record on civil and voting rights, which is that the response was always, how can you attack his personal integrity? There was never an explanation of like, well, why did you trade on behalf of this company a couple and profit off of it a week after that vote? It was all just, well, you know, don't hit my integrity.
What was really interesting is that in terms of this question of Tom Price and his the stock stuff, is that Price said that he decided to buy stock in an Australian biotech firm after receiving information from Representative Chris Collins, who is a board member of that company. He claimed in the hearing that he, you know, he was just talking to Collins about the stock. And incidentally, folks, that's called insider trading. Right. You're not supposed to get that type of information.
Right.
Price claims he just was talking broadly about the company with Collins, and then went on to do his own research and then purchase it. And
as part of this broad conversation, what websites would you recommend I go on?
But on top of that, this contradicted a fact sheet that the transition team put out, which said that Dr. Price's Morgan Stanley financial advisor designed his portfolio and directed all the trades in the account. So at first their story was like, oh, I didn't know about it. Then when it became clear that Price had talked to Collins about it, he said, well, he didn't tell me to buy the stock. He just told me about the company, Zimmer Biomet. And then I looked it up online, or I did all sorts of different research. And then I bought it because I thought, hey, this is a company that I could, in a week, make a vote to help this company out. Now, of course, he didn't say that second part, but that's what he did.
That's quite literally what happened. I mean, it's also, and it was also the approach that he used just in the sort of general's question that Senator Franken asked him about owning money in the tobacco industry, which is, you know, hey, I have people who do this for me, and I'm sure you do, Senator, and I have no idea.
Now, ethics experts say the Price could be subject to the 2012 Stock Act, which it bans insider trading by members of Congress. And if he received non-public information from Collins or others prior to purchasing the stock, he could be in trouble. But that remains to be seen. One thing that stood out over the course of this was the real, and let's move to policy here, beyond his corruption. We started to see the outlines of how they're going to try and lie to the American public. And the problem with this is that particularly when they're sitting there with people who actually know what they're talking about, the problem is, and we just have a minute here, is that when they start talking about things like risk pools and whatnot, it sounds like mumbo jumbo to, I think, average American citizens. But there was one exchange where Rand Paul was talking about how it's really important to drive down the cost of insurance, to have risk pools. So if I have four people, that's not as good as having 100,000 people. And if I have 100,000 people, that's not as good about having a risk pool full of 1 million people, because that means that some people, the number of sick people will be paid for by the non-sick people, essentially. And during the middle of that exchange, or at the end of it, Al Franken, when it was his turn to speak, said, you know what the best risk pool would be? Would be Medicare for all. And Tom Price had a small smile on his face, realizing that, oh, we should never go down this road again talking about the efficacy of risk pools.
And by the way, that is the difference between Rand Paul and Tom Price. I am quite sure that Rand Paul did not understand what had just happened. Tom Price saw that they gave away the store.
Yes, that was a classic libertarian moment. For every debate I've had with a libertarian, it sounded exactly like that, where he says, like, 100,000 risk pool is better than 1 million risk pool. Or I said, it's not as good as 1 million. 1 million is better than 100,000. Well, how about 100 million, 200 million? Well,
then we're Cuba.
Michael, thanks so much. See you back on the Majority Report. We got to take a quick break. Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, how does $10,000 a month in your pocket sound? Well, universal basic income advocate Scott Santons will be here to explain. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio.
Used to spend my nights out in a barroom.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. How does a check from the government for around $10,000 a month sound to you? Recently, Finland was the first to enact a program on a limited basis, what is believed to be the first trial run in Europe of the universal basic income. Here to talk about those benefits is Scott Santons, author of a new piece, Why We Should Have a Basic Income. So, Scott, I am a little bit, let me start off by saying I'm a little bit of a UBI skeptic, and we'll talk about that. But certainly, as we hear just another story this past week about the tremendous wealth inequality, when we hear about wages that have stagnated for 40 years relative to productivity in this country, We hear about the costs associated with healthcare and people not finding the work they want and the concerns about saving for university and whatnot. The impetus for a universal basic income is pretty clear and obvious to me. But first, let's start off. Tell us what it is.
Sure. A basic income is essentially the creation of an income floor underneath everyone. So you raise the income floor, this minimum from $0 everybody has right now, up to somewhere above the poverty line, say about $1,000 per month. That way, if we've raised that floor, then there's also so much expenses that we no longer need to spend on other things as well.
And so give us a sense of like what the history of this idea is.
Yeah, so this idea goes back quite a ways. You could say that Thomas Paine, one of our founding fathers, really kind of talked about this idea as well. It was a matter of agrarian justice, saying that everyone, like the value of the land, should be used to create essentially like a capital and a small basic income for people turning of age of adulthood, and that it should also pay for seniors as well. And this idea was that this money was essentially owned by the people, that they were the ones that created the value and they should be given it. And this idea has grown, and there's been different versions of it through the years, and we got really close to actually passing it, a version of it under Nixon. And this was when we actually even experimented with it in cities across the U.S., where a lot of people don't even know that we experimented with this in Seattle and Denver and Gary, Indiana, and New Jersey. These were called the American Income Maintenance Experiments. And
I had no idea. Tell us a little bit about those experiments.
Yeah, so this was testing essentially Milton Friedman's version of basic income, which they are very can practically be seen as identical. But a negative income tax is essentially raising someone's income up to a certain point and then slowly reducing that amount as they earn more. So it's a basic income guarantee, but essentially you're varying the amount depending on how much someone's earning. And we tested this, and we saw some interesting results in the different places we did it. We did it in metro areas and rural areas over a matter of about, the course of about a decade or so. And it was really interesting to see, what happened to how people use this money when they are guaranteed it. And we saw that one thing that people did is primary earners actually used this to spend more time looking for the next job. So this was seen as a reduction in hours worked per year, but it wasn't actually people working less. They were just like looking for a better fit for a job. And we also saw that that women who were new mothers used this as essentially a kind of a paid maternity leave. Like they were able to actually spend more time at home taking care of their newborns. And it's funny, Canada did this too in Delta, Manitoba. This experiment was actually over the entire town. So essentially the town of Manitoba for 5 years, town of Delta in Manitoba, eliminated poverty for 5 years, and we saw some very interesting effects there as well, very similar with the primary earners and new mothers, but also students actually really returned who had dropped out, even returned to school. Graduation rates went up, grades improved, and one of the most fascinating things is health actually improved such that hospitalization rates decreased 8.5%. So we've actually tried this out in the past, and we're very close to doing it, and in both places, for various other reasons, it didn't pass. Like in the U.S., there was a great concern back then that the data showed that people would divorce at higher rates. And, of course, back then it was like, oh, my gosh, we can't have, say, women escaping, households where they didn't want to be in. And, it's kind of a different world than it is now. But that was a fear, and it was actually a statistical anomaly. It wasn't really what the data showed, but that was enough of a fear that people really worried about that, and that was one of the nails in that coffin back in the 70s. And it passed the House in 1970 and didn't pass the Senate.
What's fascinating about that, regardless of whether or not it was a statistical anomaly or not, I mean, one would imagine on some level that one would expect sort of that outcome. I mean, the idea here really is that by providing a basic income to all Americans, that they will have more freedom from want so that they can actually pursue their lives in the way they want to, right? Like, I mean, like you said, yeah. I'm going to spend time looking for a job that I like more. I'm not going to live with this person anymore because, you know, I'm not going to be kept from leaving this person because I'm afraid of being destitute or not being able to, you know, needing time to build my own career or whatnot. I mean, certainly that's the a big part of the agenda.
Oh yeah, like the way that I like to refer to this too is just it's the just imagine it as the it's the power to say no. That's what really what basic income really makes possible. Is that that shifts things from involuntary to voluntary. If you have the power to say no, then to an employer, because you're earning that income as a citizen, as essentially a citizen's salary without a work requirement, then you can say, I refuse, you know, $7 an hour. I'm not going to work for that amount. I'm not going to work for that minimum wage, but I will do that job for $15 an hour or $20 an hour, or I'll do it for 20 hours a week instead of 40 hours a week. Like, you're actually able to have more bargaining power. And before, that was traditionally only possible through unions. And, of course, unions have been on the decline. But this is actually bargaining power on an individual level where people – it gives people on their own the ability to say no. And that carries with employers, and it also carries in households and relationships and many other things with the ability to say no. Another thing you could actually say no is to landlord. So if your landlord is saying, well, I'm going to raise the rent, you know, $500 per month, and say, well, okay, I can actually use this basic income and live anywhere in the U.S. And I'm not tied to my job anymore, and I'm going to say no. I'm not going to accept that kind of rent raise. I'm going to head over to, say, small town USA and start up there. And that's something that it opens up so many more options that are not available right now simply through that power.
It's fascinating. I mean, just sort of tangentially speaking, there's a lot of data out there about that sort of freedom. That show Obamacare. One of the effects of Obamacare that has been greatly underestimated is that it increased the amount of voluntary part-time employment. And so far as that people actually, there's a lot of data out there that shows that people were actually able to work less because or go into jobs that they liked more because they weren't as concerned about their health care because they had the opportunity to get it through the individual market. On some level, the principles, broadly speaking, are similar here. But let's take a break. When we come back, let's dig further into this because it's where the rubber meets the road on some level that I am a bit of a skeptic. When we come back, let's talk about like what this would actually look like if we were to implement the UBI in the United States. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire. We're talking to Scott Santons about the concept of a universal basic income. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking with author and advocate for the Universal Basic Income, Scott Santons. So, Scott, when we broke, you had basically told us about the history of the idea of Universal Basic Income. You told me something I had no idea about, that had been widely experimented with in this country in the 70s and nearly passed in this country. And we have things that are sort of somewhat similar to this, right? We have like an earned income tax credit, which is sort of
EITC grew out of that,
which is a tax rebate even if you don't pay taxes, a government payment. But what makes this different, the universal basic income? What separates it from simply welfare payments?
Sure. So the EITC is a good example of this because it works in a very similar way to negative income tax. And so this is that if you're earning $0 with an EITC, then you get nothing. But if you start earning enough money, so it shows that you're working, then it functions as giving you additional income on top of that. And so that actually works as a wage subsidy. So the effect of that also is that, say, as an employer, you know the government's going to help with the wages a little bit, so you can actually pay less, and you'll know that the government will pay more. What the basic income does is, by giving it to you without a work requirement, then it changes that wage subsidy to something that doesn't necessarily enable corporations to do that in the same way. And it also means that, whereas right now we did an EITC and, say, all these programs like food stamps and temporary assistance for needy families and Section 8 and, you know, all these other programs that we have, you can actually replace those programs with actually just giving cash. So it's really the vast simplification of both the programs that we have currently and also the tax code itself, because we do actually use the tax code to provide so many various tax credits and deductions and subsidies and these things called tax expenditures. And they actually mostly benefit those who earn a lot of money as well. It disproportionately affects them. So this is actually a more fair way of doing it, what we're currently doing, and it was a whole lot less bureaucracy and a whole lot less spending on administration expenses as well, in a way that actually benefits everyone more equitably instead of being oriented more just to those at the top.
So with a UBI proposal would come a proposal to abolish the social safety net and also to,
So this is actually, there's a whole lot of, like you say, rubber meets the road kind of stuff. And it's really, it's a oversimplification to say that we would get rid of everything. Really, it's a matter of looking at, kind of what would be unnecessary and what would we want? So like stuff like a food stamp, that makes sense as something that a basic income could replace. There's no reason to give out food stamps anymore and to target those instead. And this is actually one of the reasons why basic income, again, makes so much sense, is that the way that we means test programs means that we decide who needs it and who doesn't, and we apply these tests to it, and then you get this only if you meet that requirement. And then when you start earning money, then those benefits are pulled away, which means that you essentially see marginal tax rates of they can go to 80% and beyond, which means what is the point of working if you're going to lose mostly all of your essentially total income? And that's actually why Finland is experimenting with this, is they want to see if people will work more with this. So when we do this, it's also, let's say, imagine right now with TANF, say you would qualify for assistance if you earn $6,000 a year.
For needy
if you're
families.
Earning $12,000 a year, then you no longer qualify for the program.
Right.
So you don't even have to eliminate these things technically. By just giving people $12,000, people no longer qualify for those programs anyways, and therefore essentially those programs just kind of disappear. But that also doesn't mean that we're, say, axing Social Security or axing Medicaid and stuff. We don't need to do that. Essentially, with a basic income, we'd be effectively expanding Social Security, lowering the age limit is what we'd be doing. So, you can imagine that you could either allow those on Social Security to also choose a basic income instead, or we could actually say, well, if you're earning $1,500 in Social Security, well, let's actually give you $1,000 a month in basic income and $500 in Social Security. So there's a way to actually leave everybody at least no worse off and even better off through this, essentially smart replacement and consolidation of programs with basic income.
I mean, that's basically the game plan here, right, is to consolidate, and you would make it universal insofar as you would pay this out to everyone. My only caveats are that, A, first off, like, how much money are you talking about? Like, what would be the dollar figure that everyone would get? Because this is where it gets a little bit tricky too, right? Because you're not targeting it to necessarily people who need help. You're giving it to everyone, which there's certainly, I think universality in a lot of programs is key to its like political durability. But so how much?
Yeah. So what I talk about is, because our poverty line in the U.S. is $11,880 per year for an individual, and then it varies according to household size, that I think that it makes sense to have a $12,000 basic income at least to start with per adult individual, and also provide, say, $4,000 a month per each child. And so that way you would cover every amount of household size and essentially eliminate poverty for all household sizes. And that would cost essentially, on its face, $3 trillion. Right. However, that's not exactly the real cost because, again, everybody is paying taxes, and so that there is a point where people are paying more in than they're receiving back. And so, yes, we're giving Bill Gates money, but he's paying far more than $12,000 in
right.
additional new taxes in order to pay for this.
This
and
is
so
what,
the way this works out is very actually it's equivalent to a negative income tax
right,
as
but,
far as
see,
the cost goes.
Okay,
so essentially
– All right, so hold on. Let me just interrupt you, Scott, because we just got about two minutes left here. But that's – so in a sense, it's not really universal.
Well, it is universal. It's just you're all paying taxes on the income on top of what you're earning.
Right. So, I mean, but – so in it is universal, but for in practice. I mean, I guess that's the – that's the you know, one of the things that I think – when we start to, you say like, well, it is, it's $3 trillion, but then it's actually not $3 trillion because it's not just Bill Gates, right? I mean, we're talking about a lot of people where $10,000, not, I mean, you know, where $10,000 would help, you know, certainly at least two thirds of the population in this country, but a third may not, it's a net net wash because of taxes. So not fully universal in that sense.
Well, so you can say that it's not universal, but also you could. The fact is that you are transferring, say, $900 billion from the top to the bottom and middle. And the interesting thing, too, is that if you do it this way, you are taxing at the top. That's where the clawback comes from, is at the very top. And right now what we're doing is clawing back from the very bottom. So which way makes more sense is that should we right now continue clawing away the benefits from those at the very bottom and therefore actually preventing and missing, you create all these errors of people who should get it, who don't get it. There's so many people who need help that aren't getting it. Then there's people on the other side of that who see themselves as needing it but don't get it. Just make sure to cover everybody. And then at the very top, you're essentially, instead of creating errors where people aren't getting it who should get it, then essentially you're creating errors where people you say don't need it are getting it, and then you tax that away. And
well,
so that
I'll
way,
tell you something.
It makes
Scott,
so much more sense than what we're doing now.
It's a fascinating idea, and it's one I think that certainly people should be digging into because, you know, I have a little bit of skepticism, but it's really more about applying it. But the idea behind it, too, I think is great. And like you say, there's been experiments with it. Scott Sentence,
yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Just one other thing. When it comes to the cost, really the question is how much does it cost to not have a basic income? Like how much are we spending right now on crime and health and everything else that we actually could avoid spending by having a basic income?
Great point. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Scott Sentence is a founding member of the Economic Security Project, an advisor to the Universal Income Project, and founder of the Big Patreon Creator Pledge. That's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. Want the free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio? Go to rofpodcast.com and sign up. And the best way to support Ring of Fire and independent progressive media is by becoming a member of the show by going to rofpodcast.com. You'll get the full program without commercials and bonus content exclusively for Ring of Fire members. On behalf of Mike Papantonio, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., I'm Sam Cedar. We'll see you next week.